Hi everyone, my name is Esau.
Hi Esau.
I'd first of all like to thank Duncan for inviting me out here to do this. I'm inspired by him for what he's done for the program and for his own recovery. Truly, I'm inspired. George for service work to this particular region and how important it is for our recovery. It certainly has been important for my recovery. As you can tell, I've been coming to ACA for 4 years, and sometime within the next couple of days, it's my 4 year, which is kind of a coincidence, so that wasn't planned that way. I'd like to follow the template that's been given to me by ACA, which is experience, strength, and hope, and delivering the message that way. So I'm going to start at the very beginning. Beginning of my life. So I'll start beyond conception, which is my mother. My mother was a very beautiful young lady born in Mexico. At a very young age, she became a nun at 15 years old. She saw a couple of nuns come through town and just fell in love with the idea and decided to dedicate her mission in life to become a nun. So that was a very difficult thing to do in that part of Mexico because women have very few rights to some degree. So she had to work really hard to be able to have that opportunity. She made it. She went to the convent, and she was in the convent for about 15 years of her life. So from 15 to about 30, my numbers could be off a year or two in either direction. But what happens in 15 years, aside from being a wonderful service to her people, and she really was, she's got wonderful, wonderful stories to share. Something out of a fairy tale. It took away most of her life. It didn't take it away. I should just say that she just wasn't present socially like the rest of us are engaged in society on a day-to-day, going to school, being young, going to bars or whatever. At that age, and just getting into the natural troubles that life can present and working yourself out of them. She was of service to God, her religion, and she did it committedly and thought she was going to be there for life. She was committed. Unfortunately, because of personal political reasons within her convent, she was removed. And I don't want to tell her story here, I want to tell mine. I think that would be respectful to her and to her life. So she was removed from the convent at a late age, and she became rather resentful towards God because in her perspective, God kicked her out of her service to him. And so when she got out, she was naive and ignorant because of life out here. Life being of service, and when your life is nothing of being of service, is completely different. Everything is given to you to be of service. You don't really have to. Your work to work for being of service is just being pure and being giving. So that's all she was used to doing, was giving, 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 in a very beautiful way. But she didn't know how to survive out here, and what we consider normal. So my mom, if you can now imagine this sort of like, pardon the pun, but this like immaculate woman who was very naive, very pure, very innocent, and came from a very pure place of just devotion and giving to others who are suffering, sort of like what we do here. She, coming out of the convent, met my father. And that's where I'll stop her story and I'll start my father's story. My father was also born in Mexico. He was born and raised at a small ranch, you know, out in the backcountry of Mexico, where life was hard and life was not fun, and there were no iPhones. It was waking up before the sun comes up, and you know, tending the cattle and making food to eat every day and surviving. But that kind of life made for a hard family dynamic. His father was very rough and hard on him, so he had to run away very early on. I think the age was 13 or 14 years old. So he ran away from somewhere middle of Mexico to a little place called Tijuana. and raised himself as a young child in the streets of TJ, and moved into a brothel. Worked in and around a brothel, basically worked with prostitutes and drug addicts and, you know, all the people that you find in those types of places. So at 15 years old, it's like a candy shop or, I don't know, a potential career path. he kind of turned it into sort of like his own mixture of both candy shop slash career. He adopted that lifestyle, you know, the drugs, the alcohol, the women, the, you know, violence, guns, you know, all that stuff that we see on TV that's just on TV. That was my father. Fast forward to when he met my mother. He was a very well crafted street man, you know, very, very accustomed to drugs, alcohol, women, violence, the street, basically. And he met this woman who never really stepped foot on a street, you know, so to speak. And they fell in love. So extreme opposites here attracted. And they got together and got married. And that's where myself and my brother came along. And I think also where a lot of my father's issues really became inflamed. I think I've found that in recovery, that our issues tend to flare up in relationship. We get triggered quite heavily. So I'm imagining, based off of my work, that that's probably what I'm interpreting happened to my father. Interesting thing about my name. So now that we're talking about going back as far back as my birth, my name is Esau, right? And my name is biblical. Biblical because my mother was a nun. So for those of you who have heard the story of Esau, it comes from a story of Esau and Jacob. And I'll break it down to a very simple version of the story. The story has to do with a man whose birthright was stolen from him. So people ask me, I went to a monastery one time, and the monks would come up to me and say, "You're Esau?" I said, "Yeah, I'm Esau." And they said, "That's a really special name." I said, "I know. It's my name. I'm aware because I'm the only Esau I've ever known." And I said, "Oh, yeah, thank you." And they just had to smile from ear to ear. And they say, "It's a very interesting name. Do you know why you have it?" I said, "Because my mom gave it to me. Duh." You know what I mean? It's that simple, I thought. And then they just kind of smiled and walked away. And monk after monk would come up to me and say, "Your name is Esau. Do you know why your name?" And then I said, "Gosh, there's someone trying to ask me a question here." And one of them finally said, "You might want to look into that name, because that name's quite unique. And it's probably meaningful." And I thought to myself, well fuck, I never thought about asking why my name is Esau. I don't know. To me, it's like, why is my skin brown? It just didn't make any sense. So I went home that night and said, "Mom, let me ask you something. Why'd you name me Esau?" And she's like, "Well," I said, no, "I want the truth. I want the real version of this story. And this little reaction you're having is telling me that there's actually a story here." Well, back to the concept of Esau in the Bible, the young man named Esau's birthright was stolen by his other brother. The moral of the story more is around a birthright being stolen. She says that when I was born, my father was heavily into alcohol and drugs and women and so on and so forth, and also not being present for his wife. My father, like a lot of men in cultures, wanted a male first son, and he had that. My older brother was a man, was a boy, was a male, and so he succeeded with that. His second child, he wanted to be a girl. I was the second child. I'm not a girl. And my mother was pregnant with me and delivering me in the room, and he wasn't there. He comes in when he finally does, and he's drunk, and he's like, "Oh, you know, whatever." That was a good, you know, representation. And he says, he comes and he's like, you know, celebrating, and he's like, where's my daughter, you know? And he comes and he sees that there's a boy there, and he says, well, I got nothing, I want nothing to do with this. This is not what I wanted, so bye. And he just left. Left my mom there, who was, you know, whatever you look like when you're pregnant. I haven't been in the same room except for the day I was born. So he left her. He left her there alone to deliver me. So that's when my abandonment began. And that's how my name came to be. Because the concept of a birthright being stolen, my mom being so religious, she was in tears. She was torn apart that her own husband, who's supposed to be her husband, had just walked out on his son, whose birthright is to be loved, right? Just simply loved, whether it's by its father or by a pack of wolves. Show some love, you know?
Yeah.
And that didn't happen. He left her and he left me. And in her pain and in her suffering, she was reminded of the man named Esau from the Bible, whose birthright was stolen, and said, this reminds me of Esau in the Bible. So that's where I'm getting his name. So that hurts. It made a lot of fucking sense. I asked this question this year. I just found this out, by the way, this year. But thank God I did. With this head full of recovery, I found out. And I just said to her, man, that makes so much sense now. It makes so much sense as to why there's such a big fucking hole in my heart. Because my dad never wanted me. And when someone intends not to want you, that's different than maybe not being, they just are there, not present. But when they've got an intention not to want to be with you, there's a different layer of something there that has a very palpable effect on, I think, anything or anybody. So anyway, that explained a lot. Life only got worse after that. For some reason, my mom was always sick. My father continued to be an alcoholic, drug using, drug dealing, motorcycle riding, gun-toting maniac. And that was the man that was present many years in my life. You know, I just imagine when I was a child looking up and calling this man dad, and having that man not want me, and being there. He was very selfish man, very toxic, very much so, it's all about me, it's all about what I need, what I want right now, and if I don't get it, then I'm just going to go and do a bunch of blow and alcohol and hookers. My mom was always bedridden, I would imagine, because of this man that she called husband. At a young age, unfortunately, I had to witness my mother being taken away in ambulances like maybe once a week. And we lived in the ghetto. I lived in some pretty bad parts. I've traveled around Los Angeles all my life growing up. And they were never the nice parts of Los Angeles. Both of my parents immigrated here, and they did everything they could to survive. My mother did everything she could to support us in raising us. My father did everything he could to not be a responsible man. So where I grew up was the ghetto, which was a lot of gunshots going off at night, a lot of just suspicious characters all the time. And us as little kids wondering where daddy was and wondering why mommy's being carted away in the ambulance. It was very confusing. Most of my young life we spent traveling. And what I mean by traveling is running away. My father would show up and make a mess of things. I'll give you a quick little snapshot of what I witnessed and what I can still remember. One day in one of those homes, one of my father's women, who wasn't my mother, by the way, was enraged because she wanted my father for herself. So she came into the house, kicked the door down. I'm sitting on the floor, you know, playing Nintendo, watching the television in my pajamas, and this woman comes in with an axe and wants my father. In a good way. She wanted my mother in a bad way. She came in there to take my father and say, you know, this is the man that I love and you're just getting in the fucking way. So the TV, I hope this doesn't get too graphic, but the TV that I was watching, the lady soon started wrestling and fighting my mother in her whatever she was experiencing, and was hitting my mother's head against the TV until she broke it. So I mean, this TV that I'm watching, I'm just kind of like, just very confused, very scared, and wondering why there's blood, and why my father's kind of laughing on the lazy boy chair over there while two women are fighting. That was the last time I saw that house. That's how I ran away all the time, because whenever dad came home, that's the kind of stupid fucking shit that followed me. So, we left. Everything. Again. Friends, family, school, my bed, my blanket, whatever meant something to a child, we left over and over again. And it was just about survival. It was just about staying one step away, a step ahead of the devil, is really what it was. Because somehow he always found us. And somehow he always came back in. And somehow he always did the same fucking thing in some different way. So, when I was a young child, raised by a very religious mother, I was taught to believe in God, that God would take care of things. It was like when Santa Claus didn't bring presents, you know, I'd always think, you know, he missed my house. I kind of thought that God forgot that I existed, because the kind of shit that I was witnessing was just not cool. And the kind of things I was told about God just weren't making sense. As a young child, if God existed, and God was responsible for everything. So that's why I tell a lot of people, careful how you represent God, because to children, they believe everything, you know. And then we blame God. I blame God for everything that he wasn't fulfilling based off of what I was being told. So I started to question God early on, because God forgot about this little guy, even though I'm in his book. And so religion played a very, very heavy role in my life. ACA, thank God it addresses religion. Because I was in all of this terror, I was taught to get on my knees every night and pray. Pray, pray, pray. It'll all go away. Pray, pray, pray. And we believed it. We're sitting there going, oh my God, please. I must be doing something wrong. I mean, I'm being told that I'm a sinner. I'm being told that I'm doing something wrong. And I'm just, I know I'm not, but I don't know. There's something wrong with me, because I'm doing something wrong, and that's why I'm suffering, and that's why I'm paying for it. And that's why it's relentless, and that's why it won't stop. So religion became very, very confusing for me, and it became toxic. I didn't have that to turn to after a while. In the mayhem, abandonment appeared in so many different types of ways for me. Abandonment, to the first image, comes as maybe leaving a child behind, and then walking away, and so the child is abandoned. That's one form of abandonment, but abandonment really manifested itself in my life in so many ways. Abandonment from God, you know, at least the way I perceived God at that time. Abandonment from my father. Abandonment from the story I'm about to get to, from my mother. At some point in my life, when I was young, my mother had to leave me in Mexico. And I was born and raised in California. Ninja Turtles, Nickelodeon, Bart Simpson. So I'm a California boy. I don't know shit about cattle. I don't know shit about Mexico. I have nothing against it. I just fucking wasn't born there, so I just don't know much about it. But we were taken there because that's where all of her family came from, and that's where they were. And she had to leave us there. Me and my older brother. He's older than me by 2 years. You know, children don't understand why adults do what they do. I found out why my mom left us in Mexico. We went to Mexico and she left us there for months. It seemed like an eternity. It seemed like a lifetime. I mean, I was a child. A day without your mother is a lifetime. It's tragic. We were there for months in a country that I was not fucking familiar with. I don't give a flying fuck if that's where my parents came from. That's not where I came from. So I call home where I grew up. And now I was spending time with chickens and in the living room in cages and sodas in Ziploc bags and straws, and I'm going, you guys are fucking weird. And speaking English and not knowing how to speak Spanish and getting that weird vibe from them, which you should know how to speak Spanish because you're Mexican. And I'm like, what, dude? Like, I remember my grandma would say, what's that dude thing you're talking about? So, my mother had to leave us in Mexico because she had to take care of an abortion that she was going through. I didn't know about that until later. What I was having to survive in Mexico was a different type of predator. I remember my mom shared with me, she said that she, I love this part. This part gets me to the point where I want to cry, which is good recovery work for me. My mom told my brother and I that when the sun comes up, she was no longer going to be there. And my older brother said to her that he wasn't going to go to sleep that night. She said, why? And she said, because if I stay awake, the sun won't come up. And you won't have to leave. And we woke up and she was gone. So now we were helpless. Truly helpless. Two little California boys in downtown Mexico, God knows where, and I don't give a fuck either. And so we were victims. We were easy targets for people that knew that these two kids didn't know up from down, left from right, and didn't know how to speak Spanish, and didn't know how to tell anybody that anything's happening to them either. So I'm not going to get into graphics, but me and my brother were sexually abused in Mexico because we were easily victimized. And that had its effect. We were helpless and hopeless and confused and terrified. The things that occurred affected my older brother in a way where he became very violent. He became a very violent young man, very angry. And unfortunately, I became his punching bag most of my life. It's kind of heavy to say this, but he beat me all the time, and I try to just speak the truth for what it is. And sometimes the truth is kind of hard to hear, but when I speak the truth, I'm honoring my truth, and I don't want to sugarcoat it anymore. You know, I like to tell my sponsees and fellow travelers, say it the way it was. You know, reserve the specifics for your sponsor or a trusted fellow traveler, but when you get a chance, say what happened, for crying out loud. It's about fucking time, because it's the truth. And so my brother's way of dealing with everything that he was unable to comprehend, he took it out on me. And I took his anger for many, many years. And that really fucked me up. I became terrified of violence. I I had night terrors. I've had night terrors. I've had night terrors all my life until I walked into the rooms of ACA. ACA cured that too. I was afraid to go to sleep. I was afraid to wake up. Being alive sucked. Going to sleep sucked. Because in my dreams, it just got worse. You know, the demons, the devils, the atrocious monsters that young children can create with their fragile minds are pretty profound. We're very creative when we're children. And I mean, I wet my bed. I was a child, right? I was terrified. I thought I was defective. You know, how can I share this with anybody? It's embarrassing, you know. But I didn't know nobody else was going through what I was going through, you know. I thought that somehow all this weird shit's normal. It got pretty heavy. And that was my young, before my teen years. My teen years, as I grew up, the alcoholism with my father stopped. And I picked it up. Because by that point, I was old enough to sort of like isolate, lock the door so that my brother wouldn't come in. my brother was old enough to date, and he was old enough to leave, so there's no reason to kick my ass anymore, right? He had better things to do. If I did come around and kick my ass, but I just didn't come around. Learned not to trust. So I became isolated. My way of dealing with what became a very, very deep, deep, deep and profound depression in my teenage years was alcoholism and drugs. I didn't think I was going to make it to the age of 18. I actually would live my life every day because in my head I thought I was going to die by the time I was 18 because I was just on a downward path of self-destruction because there was this huge black hole inside that was just pulling on everything that I had any glimpse of light, love, life I had, it would just suck it right in. It just didn't matter. So I didn't know how to maintain a level of peace, happiness, stillness. I couldn't sleep because sleeping was scary as hell. So suicide played a role in my life. I was either going to do myself in from drugs and alcohol or from just extremely negative excitement. I did what I could to fit in gangs, right? It's interesting because the gang thing, I understand it. You know, they're a family that accepts me. And yeah, so what that they do all these things, but they're showing me some version of love. So I was willing to do it. I was willing to join because I was desperate for that connection. I didn't know it at that point, but I know it now looking back. So I understand why young kids do that kind of stuff. My first suicide attempt, I remember, was about 10 years old. I ask myself this question all the time. I don't know how a child at that age even knows what suicide is. But somehow I knew I wanted to die. Because the pain was that bad, even at that age. Anyhow, I survived 18, which is a miracle. Because I was having a lot of fun. Alcohol and drugs. Fill in that hole. But as soon as I sobered up, I was sad again. I was depressed again. And so, again, the cycle starts. Let me get high. Let me get drunk. Let me do something that's going to get me out of myself. And that's how the cycle starts, and that's how the cycle is maintained. The one thing that took me out of drugs, alcoholism persisted in my adult years, but what got me out of the drugs and what I thought got me out of the depression was marriage, was finding a woman. The other drug of my choice was another woman, another distraction. And I felt something that I hadn't been feeling and that made me feel good, which was attention from someone, you know, and tenderness of some sort. But she was just as fucked up as I was. She was an ex-heroin addict, alcoholic, you know, and I was in love. Why not? Mom and Dad did it. It was cool, you know. So I fell in love with a good old tragic story waiting to happen. But it was better than the depression I was feeling. So that was my motivation to get into a relationship, get married, and move out. And so I did. Moved 3,000 miles east of Kentucky. Got on a Greyhound bus, one-way ticket, and got married. Yeehaw, you know? Finally, getting away from this horrible depression, horrible life, and horrible family. And then that's when it just started back up again, you know? Because the book just nails me with that. Oh, we recreate our life with in relationships, you know? So she became even more alcoholic and much of a drinker. And that relationship became violent. I'm not a violent man. I do not like violence. I will not put my hands on another human being because I don't like it. But I didn't know how to protect myself from the violence. So the violence was placed upon me in that marriage. And so I, again, fell into that depression. The distraction wasn't working. Started getting depressed again. So I got out of that relationship and found yet another woman, right? Another something else to distract me from me. Of course, I didn't know what was going on inside, so I just kept looking. At least I can give myself that, right? I kept looking for something to help with this feeling. I found another woman and fell absolutely in love. Thought I had figured it out. Thought I nailed it. Thought that I won the ticket and God did exist. He found me. He knows where I live. And he delivered her to my front doorstep. And I thought that my luck had changed. But what hadn't changed was me. All that changed was just what was around me, you know, the environment, the person. What I found out, and she was a much better person than my ex-wife, but what I found out in that relationship, it failed as well. It eventually became dysfunctional, and it was a very tragic loss that I had to walk away from. It eventually somehow it built itself up to a violent situation that I had to walk away from. And it's a very, very interesting coincidence today that Duncan asked me to speak. It's my 4-year trip, because today's the last time I saw her 4 years ago. I walked away and never picked up the phone. Never saw her again. And she was the woman of my dreams. I'd fallen in love. She was my Marilyn Monroe. I was head over heels for this woman. And that relationship, leaving that relationship, which I could admit was even harder than my life, was leaving that relationship, because that relationship epitomized what I considered to be the solution to this problem that I had inside, right? This feeling of being loved. I was with her for 10 years, by the way. So 4 years ago today was the last time I saw her. And unfortunately, that had to end. What I found out in my step work was something very powerful, which was that it didn't matter if I found the perfect woman, perfect partner, because I was going to fuck it up, because I didn't know how to be. She was great. She'd pay me compliments, and I'd say, "Oh, get out of here. That ain't me." You know, I didn't know how to speak up for myself, so I was teaching her how to not respect me. Little by little, I was just chipping away at what she naturally brought to the table. And because I had no idea how beautiful I was. I had no idea what I was worth. I had no idea that I was worth living. I didn't know how to accept it. I didn't know how to take it. I didn't know how to receive it. And if you gave it to me, I said, "That's not for me." So I couldn't hold on to it. So one of the most difficult things I ever had to realize, which I sometimes wish I could close that fucking door, was that I contributed to the dissolvement of that beautiful relationship, because I was not healthy enough to be a healthy man. Mm-hmm. But that was a very profound realization through the steps that, you know, they always told me, well, you'll find your picker's broken. Oh, your picker's broken. That's what it is. I said, no. My picker works perfectly fucking fine. I will find the woman that will become an alcoholic. Yes. I will find her. Trust me. And if I don't find her, I'll make her one. Because I'm fucked up. And when I realized that, I'm like, okay, yeah, that's right. ACA, no relationships for a year. I'll give you two. Because I'm fucked up. It ain't them. It's me. I had to fix me. Because I could find the perfect woman, but she was just simply... But I wouldn't know how to accept her love. So it'd just be wasted. That's what I discovered in the rooms. That is what... That story of my ex is the biggest tragedy of my life, I consider. All the earlier stuff, I mean, I'm over it in a way. All the abuse from my childhood. But as an adult, like, the biggest tragedy of my life as an adult male is leaving the woman that I love. But it's also the thing that gave me the most beautiful gift of my life. It's the thing that was such a tragic loss that it brought me to my knees. And if we're paying attention to the way the program works, it's when we're on our knees, when we're begging, please, and saying my life's unmanageable, is when we start the first step. That's when we understand that we need help. And that's what I thank her for from a distance, wherever she is. I don't know, because I can't open that chapter again. I can't pick up that phone. But because of her, I found the program. I was in so much pain. I was extremely heavily codependent. I could not live without another person in my life. And when I walked away from her, which was a miracle, I was alone. Which, if you guys are in here, then I'm assuming you guys have a sense of abandonment. Well, I was the king of abandonment. What does Sting say? I'm the king of pain or something like that. I mean, that song's for me. I didn't know how to breathe. My breath was taken away the second I was by myself. I felt like I was dying if I felt like somebody wasn't in my life. I could be in a room full of people dying, sweating, really about to pass out if I thought that my girlfriend was leaving me. So now here I was walking away from her. How the hell? I don't know to this day. I know how I did it. I mean, it was just finally realizing that something clicked in my head, and I said, you know, I'm going to die trying to figure this out. I'm going to die trying. And I know that it's through this horrible pain that's inside of me. And so again, the biggest tragedy of my life revealed the most life-changing aspect to my life, which was the program. It's interesting, you know, in program we experience these like strange coincidences, right? So at that point when I left her, it had been about 15 or 20 years since I had spoken to God, because God didn't exist, or God didn't like me, or whatever I was thinking when I was a kid. But man, you get enough pain and that three-letter word comes out of your mouth. I'm like, God! And I'm like, I don't even believe in you, but God! And I'm like, help me! Because I had nothing. I was literally by myself for the first time in my life. Just by myself. The epitome of it. And I said, God, please help me with this. Now that I'm all by myself, please help me. And so, I put one foot in front of the other. I had not found 12-step programs yet. Funny thing is I went out to the desert, out towards Pahrump, Nevada, and was taking some self-defense courses out there, and met a woman who I was just chatting with, and she said, have you ever heard of ACA? And I said, no. I don't know what you're talking about. And she says, you ought to try it. Here's this thing, paper, whatever. I'm like, whatever. Put it in my pocket. Said, yeah, sure, why not, whatever. But you know how that goes. I didn't do it. I went back a couple months later, and she was working again. And she sees me there, and I'm taking a class, and she says, did you ever look at that website I told you about? I said, no. But I said to myself, yeah, it's the second time she tells me that. It's kind of weird, you know. I'll check it out. So I looked it up and said, okay, you know, there's a meeting, and there's like this thing. So my first meeting was in Pasadena. And when I walked in, I found home. I knew it. The first meeting. The first second I walked into the room. The kind of stuff that people were sharing was just what I just shared with you. As honestly as I could. Without blinking. Just brutal, raw honesty. And I was in love. People were sharing about abuse. People were sharing about the truth. People were saying what happened. And people were being allowed to say it. In a room full of people. It was just mind-blowing. And I said, I don't know what the hell these people are doing, but I need to come back. It was just really interestingly weird. So I started doing research. And I said to myself, I'm going to find all the meetings I can find. I don't know if you have, any of you have felt that. I started going to every freaking meeting, different meetings here and there, in the back alley of some other place and in some church over here, and just started sorting them out till I found home. I found the Pit in Westlake, which is what I consider my home group and where I grew up. I remember when I first found my sponsor, he was standing outside walking into the meeting with his red book, and I was, here I am, this 20, 30 some odd year old man, you know. Not really someone that you would think would be scared of anything. And I walked to him with that little inner child self. I'm like, is this the right place for the meeting? And he just gives me that smile and he says, you're in the right place. What perfect invitation, right? What perfect words to bring me into what I would consider home. And that's how my relationship started with ACA. I fell in love. Didn't mean it was easy. I sat in the corner of the room every week for a while, terrified to open my mouth. My chest was pounding every time I went in there. Every time it started getting closer to me, I'm like, oh, fuck, it's about to be me. And I felt like, oh, my name is Esau, and, you know. That's what it felt like. That's what it felt like when I was speaking. Of course, that's not what it sounded like. It's just what it felt like. I felt like I was going to die. But I kept coming back. The message was simple. It was keep coming back. It works if you work. And I knew something. That every time I left that room, I felt better. And I didn't know why. I didn't know why I felt better, but I did. They talked about getting a sponsor. And that terrified the hell out of me. Because every man in my life either beat me or left me. Or other things that weren't really nice. So here they are, there's this program saying, you know, get a sponsor, and we prefer you get one that's of your same sex. I'm like, fuck. And I really wanted to work this program. It took me a while to muster up the strength to ask the sweetest man I know to be my sponsor. It wasn't like it was Mike Tyson or anything like that. It was just. But that's how heavy this stuff is for us grown adults. It's like, that's our most vulnerable place. That's why we recover, because we're vulnerable enough and courageous enough in that moment to make that first step. And so I did. And like, okay, I did it. Awesome. Got a sponsor. Now they said call him, and I said, fuck. Because I don't know if you guys have felt that, but when I first walked in the program, I'm like, you want to call somebody? And what? And why would he even answer the phone? God, that was the next hardest thing I had to do. I would just look at that phone and just do this with my hands and just go like, oh my God, is he going to pick up? What if he does? What are we going to talk about? What am I going to tell him? And it was awkward for me for a while, you know. It was, hi, so what's up, you know? Like, how you doing? And I love him to death, and I tell him that to this day. I knew he knew what was going on inside of me, because he's sitting there waiting for this phase to, you know, just phase away. How you doing? I'm okay, yeah. I'm all right. And when he started answering the phone, And I got to tell you, that's one of the most beautiful and profound things that has changed my life, was simply someone answering the phone consistently. That's why sponsorship is so important, because it provides us with such a beautiful way of healing. Someone shows up, and for me, that's a big deal. You guys just heard a little snippet of my life. Someone showed up for me. It was weird. And he kept showing up consistently. That was weird. And he was a man. That was weird. It's so funny because, I was suspicious. What does he want? What does he want from me? Why is he doing this? I kept trying to figure him out. Never nothing. He just wanted me to be healthy. And so I started the steps. The next colossal step was doing the steps. And I took it serious. I took it very serious. I took it as though my life depended on it. I have a brother in Narcotics Anonymous who, thank God that program exists, because it saved his life. And I used to go with him to Narcotics Anonymous before I found ACA. And when I saw the energy in there, and I just saw the way that they were there for each other, and the way they celebrated each other's clean time, and they hugged each other, I said, fuck, I wish something like this existed for me. I really did say that, because I had no idea we existed, by the way. I had no idea. Talk about these little coincidences, you know what I mean? And so I learned from them this passion for the steps. They talked about how the steps needed to be done because it saved their lives. And here I was in the rooms of ACA, and I like to tell people that my heart will beat without my help. I don't need to do anything, and it'll keep me alive. So technically I'm alive, but I was the living dead. Up until I walked into the rooms of ACA, I wasn't alive. So when I found this whole story, this whole concept of like, if you don't do the steps, you'll die, because they will die in Narcotics Anonymous. They'll die quick if they keep using. I thought to myself, well, it applies to me too. Except my death is a slow death. I don't live my life. I get to live to the age of whatever and really just kind of like not have anything in here. It'll just be living, but life doesn't ask me to do anything to live. This thing just pumps. So I said, I need to work this program because I'm not living and I want my life back. So I worked the steps. I worked the steps with a magnifying glass, word for word. And I'll always remember the way my sponsor opened my eyes to it. And he said, well, let's work the steps. I said, all right. And he says to me, well, let's do the steps. What's the first word in the first step? I'm like, I don't know. Something about powerlessness or something. And he's like, what's the first word in the first step? We? What's your fucking point? And he goes, that's one of the most important things of this program. He says, we can't do this alone. He says, that first word alone should be enough. That's how I worked my program, one word at a time. Because I said, well, I get it, you're right. These rooms are filled with us. And every time I leave here, I feel so much better. The fellowship is what made me feel whole again. Not me. I had been living all my own for 30 some odd years, and I didn't feel any better. So I thought to myself, well, they put a lot of thought in this book. Maybe I should read it. And so I did, word for word. And I took it serious, word for word. And I believed everything they said, because everything that they were promising was coming true. I was feeling better consistently without alcohol, without drugs, without a girlfriend, without a partner, without somebody else in my life, in that way. That's a miracle. for this guy. 30 some odd years of living on some form of dependency. And now all I had to do was walk into this room and walk out between then and the next meeting, and I felt good enough to not pick up one of those items for the wrong reasons, you know? There's nothing wrong with the relationship, but why was I going into it? That's what I'm trying to say. What's my intention? What's motivating me? Is it because I don't want to be alone? That's not love. Love is me being whole and complete and taking that man to somebody else and saying, here's a whole man for you to love. There. That's love. Love isn't, I love you, but just don't. That's all I knew. So I committed my life to the program. I picked up service commitments, simple ones, secretary, because I knew I'd get myself. If I owed myself to you, then I know I would show up, you know? Because sometimes in recovery, it's like, well, I don't feel like going today, you know? I don't know, whatever. I'll make up whatever excuse not to go to a meeting. And I thought to myself, I get it. Complacency. So, secretary, yes, right here. And I'm like, put your hand down. And I'm like, no! You know, it's like the false self and the true self are like going at it. And I'm like, that's how hard it was for me. So I tricked myself, get your ass in the service. Because I know you're going to figure out a way to not come back. But if I had to come back for you guys, I would do it. I'm okay with that level of codependency until I would do it out of the true nature of service work. In the beginning, I needed you guys in that way. I needed to be here for you guys because I couldn't be here for myself. So service work. I was terrified to do it, but I did it. And I kept coming back. It kept me consistent with my program. It kept me connected. That makes me want to cry because I've made the most, my entire circle of friends and family are program people today. And I'm in love with every single one of you guys because I feel loved every day. Like genuine love. True, unattached, unicky, just real, pure, simple, no strings attached. Love. In whatever form it takes, however simple, whatever you're willing to give. Whether it's a hug, whether it's a thanks for those 3 minutes, that was awesome. Thanks for being so honest in those 3 minutes. Time after time in the meetings, when people came up to me and remembered who I was and gave me a hug when I walked in, every fucking hug healed me. I swear to God it did. I became the best hugger you'd ever met. I went from like, why are you hugging me? And then, why, you know, men, why are you hugging me? You know what I mean? I remember when, I hope it's not crosstalk, but I remember when Duncan first hugged me. I met him at a workshop. And I'm like, it was my first workshop in Santa Barbara. And he's like, hi, welcome. And he hugged me. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? I've never told him that, but I was new back then. Hugs scared me. I love you, Duncan. I really do. I hug him myself now, you know. But I kept coming back. And the same thing found me consistently every time. You guys. People willing to heal. People willing to recover. People that were feeling pain, but despite the pain, were willing to come back and do something about it. And they were willing to love each other, support each other, pick up the phone for each other. Every single time. Like that, I don't know if anyone has noticed, but that's profound. If I step out of a room, no one picks up the phone to if I call some random friend at work, what are you calling me about that for? Stop being fill in the blank. You know what I mean? I don't get that kind of support outside of these rooms. I don't get that kind of connection. I don't get that kind of love. It's not taught out there for some reason. Hell, I don't even find it in my own family. But I found it in these rooms consistently every single week. Or as often as I was willing to show up to a meeting. So, I did my 12 steps. And I was pleased with myself. And, you know, I'd like to share one thing that I learned from my fourth step. It was profound. One thing was that I didn't even realize my father was an alcoholic. And I'm an adult children of alcoholics, right? I swear to God, I didn't even know until I was in my fourth step that my dad was an alcoholic. Why? Because there was so much other shit going on in my life, alcohol was the least of my worries. But that led me to my second realization, which was, why am I in ACA? Right? You know, people come in here, my father was an alcoholic. My father was a drug addict. Or I was abandoned. Or I was this, or I was that. One thing or the other thing. And I was like, well, fuck, I got them all. Why am I here? Like, how do I identify when I come in here? Because, I mean, you know, some form of identification for myself, like some clarity. And what I realized in my fourth step was that I was, what I suffered from tremendously, and that what really changed my life after I realized this is that I was subjected to this type of environment where alcoholism, drug abuse, violence, watching violence, being the victim of violence, being abandoned, I was just subjected to it. I was allowed to be, that was allowed to be done to me. So I looked at that and said, holy cow. And I looked at my life and said, makes sense. It makes sense, because now I look at my life and I see that all these situations in my life are unpleasant. So I continue to introduce myself to unpleasant experiences throughout my life and think that it's acceptable. Well, guess when my life started to change? Thank you, fourth step. You know what I mean? It just like opened my mind. I'm like, I learned that it was okay to be subjected to, what do you got? What do you got? Give it to me and I'll take it. At least my parents thought that was okay. So now as an adult, I just walk into any situation that you're like, this, sure, why not? I'll take it. Why not? I didn't know what was not okay. I had no idea. But I do now. I do now. With a fire greater than the fires of hell inside of me, that will I allow anyone to mistreat. That's unheard of for me. Unheard of. I am today pleasantly without a relationship, very intentionally, because I want to experience this new freedom, this new health, this new sense of life. I've been enjoying my life for the first time in my life. I don't know how to put it into words. I'm a dancer today. When I was growing up, men weren't supposed to dance. I got rehearsal tomorrow. I've got rehearsal for the next, every weekend for the next couple of months. Why? Because I've got the courage to follow my heart today. Because I have the courage to listen to my heart. And because I can see my heart, I can feel it. You know, it thawed out. All that pain, all that abuse made me very hard intentionally because I didn't want to feel. It really hurts. But today I get to feel. Today I get to live my life. Today I get to be of service. My recovery has taken me to amazing places. Today I conduct workshops. They terrify me. I'm scared when I'm up there. I'm like, but I've had a spiritual awakening, and I want to give back. I speak whenever I'm asked. I'm of service whenever I'm asked, because I'd like to give back. So what was so freely given to me, I will be in debt to ACA till the day I die. I can't even put that into words, because it gave me my life. People talk about, well, that meeting's kind of far. What the fuck's your recovery worth then? What's your recovery worth? I know what my recovery is worth. I'll drive wherever the fuck I have to. Because back in the day, when I was in that depression, I'd say, God, I'll do anything. Anything. And then when the solution is right in front of you, you're like, well, that meat is kind of far. I'm not really feeling good right now. Well, then maybe that's why you're not recovering so quick. I don't care where I got to go. I don't care what I got to do. If I feel uncomfortable inside, I know that's where I got to go. I don't know what else to say. I'm in love with this program. I'm in love with what it's done for me. I'm in love with what it's doing through me. I'm in love with the evolution of me. I can't wait to find out who I'm going to be tomorrow. Because for the first time in my life, I'm not stopping myself. I'm not teaching someone how to make sure that I stay in that dysfunctional place. Every day, with the mirror work, making the phone calls, speaking to fellow travelers, I'm evolving as a man. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. If there was one man on this planet that this program could not save, was me. It was me. Guaranteed. Guaranteed. I was proven wrong. And I'm here right now to tell you the story that it's possible if we just do the work. If we just sponsor one another. If we just pick up the phone. If we just keep going to meetings. If we just keep coming back, if you just hug someone, if you just allow someone to hug you, this change can happen. Thank you all for letting me be of service to you and be of service to myself by being here and sharing my story with you. Sincerely, I really, really do appreciate it. Thank you.
God, grant me the strength to accept people.